Hello and welcome to Sync Music Matters, a podcast that explores the beautiful relationship between music and the moving image. My name's Jim Holstrip and I'm your host on this journey, as each week I chew the fat with industry professionals who, on a daily basis, work with music for visuals. Now you might immediately assume that I'm talking about composers, but I'm also talking about editors, music supervisors, directors, and anyone else who's involved with the synchronous process of pairing audio and visuals. Today I'm talking to music producer and creative director Jules Bromley. So the regulars amongst you will have noticed that I've changed the title music. Well, that's because Jules is the creative director of UK-based trailer music label Evolving Sound, and I thought it fitting to have a particularly bombastic piece of trailer music as the opening gambit. The track is called Legends Don't Die, was written and produced by me, and is courtesy of the lovely people at AudioSocket ASX. So, in episode 3 of Sync Music Matters, I was chatting to Emma Middleton, who is a trailer music supervisor. Now, Evolving Sound is the kind of trailer music label that someone like Emma might go to when looking for the perfect piece of music for a theatrical trailer. And by trailer music, we mean the music that's featured in the trailers for movies and TV series releases that we see on TV or online or in the cinema. As creative director, Jules is the visionary that exec produces custom work with trailer houses and the writing of albums of trailer music. Essentially, he chooses the creative direction, writes the briefs, and brings together the composers and project manages the process from conception to completion. We go under the skin of Jurassic Park Dominion, which was a recent custom trailer job involving Evolving Sound. That's easy for you to say. I asked Jules to break down the process of how trailers come into being, from a studio starting to shoot a movie to the final trailer that hits the screens on the run-up to a movie being released, and of course where the music fits into that process. Jules also has a fascinating backstory as someone who studied land economy and foreign languages at Cambridge University before quitting in his late 20s to pursue a career in music. As always, all the music that we discuss in the show is linked to in the show notes. If you are that way inclined, I would be hugely grateful if you could pop over to Apple Podcasts and leave a review and a rating. It just helps the podcast reach as many people as possible. So sit back, relax, grab yourself a cup of tea and a Jaffa cake, and enjoy the chat with Jules Bromley. And as an addendum to that, we do actually touch on the age-old conundrum, which philosophers have wrestled with for millennia, as to whether or not a Jaffa cake is technically a cake or a biscuit. Jules is the creative director at UK trailer music label Evolving Sound. Evolving Sound's mission is to deliver unparalleled dramatic music, which is designed specifically for theatrical promotion. Their tracks are custom built to enrich, enhance, illuminate, and contextualize awesome visual content. Some of their recent syncs include Jurassic World Dominion, 1917, Last Night in Soho, and Don't Breathe 2. Jules' career actually began in dance music production and remixing, with a host of remix credits for the likes of Texas, Brand Van 3000, and David Arnold. He spent many years writing production music and has written for 25 albums on the Universal Production Music Catalogue. Jules Bromley, thanks very much for joining me.
Hey, Jim. You actually counted how many albums I've written for. That's amazing.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'd love to say yes, but actually I just did some digging and that was actually on the Universal, the UniPPM website.
Oh, right. Okay.
Yeah. Golly. And a picture of you, because I had to, initially I was like, is that Jules? Because it was quite a long time
yeah,
ago.
Yeah, sorry, I'm all grey now. Yeah, barely recognisable.
thanks very much for joining. So, I mean, the starting point for this podcast, as always, is if you were to cast your mind back to a kind of young 5 to 10 year old Jules Bromley gallivanting around the streets of Cheshire, and someone had asked you what you would like to be when you grow up, what would have been your response?
God. Didn't everybody want to be a footballer when they were 5 to 10 years old? I'm pretty sure I did. I was shit at football as well. So,
who would you have been?
Oh God, no, I would have played for Man City. They were, okay. Still are my team, I suppose.
Right.
Yeah, and then music kind of really started in the teens for me. And then I think there was probably a brief dalliance with wanting to be an actor. So yeah. Right. Basically just desperately clamouring for attention and celebrity, you know.
Yeah, well, as a footballer, certainly today they seem to be pretty powerful. Well, I suppose actors as well, they're probably amongst the most powerful celebrities.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know, I've had a rethink about actors. I don't think they're as influential as we think they are. I think they are, you know, they're enormously talented, but basically, you know, tools within a very manipulative industry. And I feel sorry for them sometimes. I think they get, you know, they get a bad rap. And at the end of the day, they're contracted to say and do a lot of stuff that they probably don't want to say and do, and they have to work bloody hard. So,
Well, thank God there's Ricky Gervais, who's available to keep them in check at the Golden Globes. So what was that initial dalliance with music after wanting to be a footballer?
Oh, God, I suppose from... So, I mean, I had a musical family. My my grandmother on one side was an opera singer. My other grandmother was a music teacher, a piano teacher and singer. Had studied at the Royal Northern College. My dad played jazz trumpet. So we had a musical family, but I didn't learn music. I mean, I learned to play the piano when I was a kid, and was in bands from sort of early teens. And that's kind of really where it got its hooks into me. But I didn't have any formal training. I didn't acquire through my academic learning period much in the way of skills. So I came out the other end of university and I didn't study music. I studied something completely unrelated, went into a completely unrelated job until I was probably, I think I packed in my day job when I was 27, 28. Having, you know, always played in bands, always been doing remixes for friends, building studios and beta testing, whatever I could get my hands on.
May I ask what that unrelated degree was?
Yeah, it was land economy and foreign languages. Yeah, modern languages at Cambridge a long time ago. Yeah.
And which languages?
German and Spanish.
Ah, yeah, so good.
Yeah, let's not go there. I worked in London and was trying to find a pathway into music, and it probably took me sort of 6 or 7 years until late 20s. I packed in the day job, got a job at a recording studio in West London, which I don't think is there anymore, called Eden Studios. Just as an assistant, I think I basically figured out that I'd saved up enough money to survive for a year. I wasn't getting paid, and I just needed, as a lot of people do, I think you just need that springboard. You just need a sort of, you know, an exit from whatever the mundane day job is that you're not happy with, to do something that, you know, you really feel is your passion. And I was very lucky; it worked out for me. Worked bloody hard, I have to say. So, yeah, worked at the studio as an assistant for probably 6 months, and then set up a dance record label in London called Planet Nice Records with a friend, and then got into remixing off the back of that, which, again, was just a stroke of good fortune. We'd done a dance release for a record label in South London called Resolution, and that got picked up by Echo, was it called? Echoes? It was a music magazine or paper that was around in the 90s. The guy who was the music reviewer there was a friend of Ashley Heath, who was the editor at The Face, and he was also Charlene Spiteri's boyfriend, loved the track, rang me up, asked if I'd do a remix for one of Texas's singles, Black Eyed Boy, I think it was, and that sort of led me into remixing and helped me sort of keep a roof over my head. And as with most people in music, I had various fingers in various pies for lots of years. I had a record deal with V2 Records with a band called Columbo. Did a great music video with Lionel Blair, God rest his soul.
Can we see that?
It's still up on YouTube, actually, believe it or not. If you Google Columbo and Lionel Blair, I'm sure it'll emerge from the ether.
Be sure to put a link in the, the show
don't,
notes.
Please
to that.
Don't. and I like you, I got into sync music as a sort of means of just stabilizing what is otherwise a highly volatile career and just getting a bit of regular income, I guess. and was a jobbing composer for 20 years, doing TV commercials, some short films, lots of production music, some documentary work, whatever came along, basically. Some commission, some production.
Was there a particular catalyst that, you know, in your late 20s led you to... Because I could very much relate to that story, because I was the same. I had a day job, and it was in I think I was about 30 at the time when I decided to chance it. Had enough money to save up to pay the bills for a year with a view to, you know, worst thing that happens is I make have a year making music and then have to go back to what I did, but fortunately didn't have to. Was there a particular catalyst that led you to go, right, now's the moment, and gave you the courage to make that decision?
That's a really good question. I think the misery, basically, of a job I hated eventually reaching saturation point. Yeah, and then just thinking, actually, I suppose I realized there didn't need to be a sort of seamless transition, and there was probably never going to be a seamless transition from a well-paid professional career in one field, just, you know, smoothly slipstreaming into something equally stable in the music world. That was never going to happen. And that sort of realization gradually dawned. And I think when I got the assistant at Eden Studios job, I thought, well, that's probably as good as it gets. Okay, so there's no money, but at least there's a purpose, there's a reason to get up in the morning. There's a studio to go to, there's stuff to learn, there's people to meet. And it was great, you know, and it starts you on the path, and it was terrifying. But, you know, not having that income stream is a bit terrifying. And I didn't know, I thought, well, the worst that can happen is I have to go back and do what I was doing before. But you know, I just got lucky. It worked out, and there were a few kind of hairy years, and then things kind of settled down, and you think, actually, this is probably going to be okay. Having said that, you know, it's now 25 years later. I still have days when I wake up and think, shit, you know, is Evolving Sound still going to be here in 6 months? It's a tough industry, you know, and it's not getting any easier, and it's tough for composers, and it's tough for people who run businesses like this. And, you know, things are changing. The business model surrounding production music has changed dramatically in the last 20 years, which is one of the reasons why I kind of wanted to get away from mainstream production music, just because it seemed to be evolving into a bit of a race to the bottom, in that there was one business model after another which seemed to want to charge less and less money for people to use, you know, really well-crafted music. And I think that's a great shame, and I think that's a real problem for the industry. Whereas trailers, because of the nature of the assets they're promoting, they have budget. And if it's the right piece of music, they'll pay good money for it. And they don't, you know, it's not about $50 a month subscription and getting as much money as you can for nothing. It's about finding the right cue and making sure it's all about quality and production values and so on and so forth, customization and getting things absolutely spot on, perfect, live music, orchestras, you know. It's just a different kettle of fish. And to me, that resonates, that it's an industry that values music still. It's an industry that, you know, doesn't try and stiff people. Okay, look, you get clients who are tough, and there's always haggling and negotiating when we do a sync. But the whole ethos is just very different.
That was one of the reasons I was very keen to talk to you, because I think that commitment to quality and commitment to the music is apparent in your catalogue and in Evolving Sound's ethos. And I think I agree. There's a whole new world of sort of micro licensing now, and sort of production music sort of evolving into that. And I think I too am a sort of purist and believe that, you know, you're only as a composer. It's funny, I read an article this week from Alan Shearer, and he was talking about when he was back playing football, there was a saying that you're only as good as your last game. And his ethos was, you're only as good as your next game. And I kind of really feel that with music as well. That drive to improve and to get better comes from looking to the next one rather than sort of sitting on your laurels. And I think that really kind of resonates with me. You mentioned you sort of spent 20 years as a jobbing composer. Was it the change in the music industry and the change in production music which was the catalyst for you to then go, okay, well, from composer to now I'm going to be the person, you know, exec producing music and bringing in the composers and sort of running a business?
It was partly that. It was partly that. It was, there were definitely there were certain key moments. I remember one of the big publishers changing the splits that they were offering to composers, and I just thought, you know, it had always been 50-50, and all of a sudden it wasn't 50-50 anymore. And that, I think, marked a real turning point. I was also, you know, Evolving Sound was very much a sort of a creative direction rather than a business idea. I was just crazy about trailer music. I'd had some trailer placements with other labels, and I was just excited about exploring that whole sort of trailer universe. And this was primarily originally intended as a vehicle to do that. You know, I just loved the drama, the production values, a lot of parallels with dance music in terms of obsession with production values, pacing, timing, the drops, the builds, you know, the fixation with the latest cutting edge sounds, the way, you know, dance music and trailer music, the signature sounds are always evolving and changing. I love all of that. You know, that really excited me. So it's, you know, it started off, and I wrote, I think, on our first three albums, and then I realized within a few months that there was just no way I could continue writing as well as do a decent job of running Evolving Sound as a dedicated music label. So I just basically made a commitment to be creative director, stop composing. And also there was just, you know, I was aware there was such awesome talent out there. I didn't need to write. You know, there were great composers I wanted to work with. And so that kind of made the decision that much easier. You know, I started working with a few composers and I thought, look, this stuff is better than I'm writing. And I'm not being sort of falsely humble there. It really was. It was just really, 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 really good stuff. So that's kind of how it evolved. I mean, and I have to say, I was totally clueless about the trailer industry when we started out. And the first couple of years were really tough and a huge learning experience. But I was lucky enough to get a bit of help here and there, have great supportive clients. And, you know, it started slowly. You get a little placement here, a bit of sound design, and then gradually, I don't know how it works, that the brand starts to get recognized, word gets around, things get picked up. And yeah, touch wood. And as I say, I wake up every morning and think, God, are we still going to be here in 6 months? But yeah, it's been a roller coaster, but it's been great.
Yeah, I suppose that's symptomatic of any, you know, if it's your company or even, you know, myself as a freelancer, it's not quite like when you're employed and you just know you're going to get paid every month. It's sort of you're directly responsible for making sure that things do continue to grow and move forward.
Yeah, you have to stay focused on the stuff you have control over. And that primarily is just creating great music. So that obviously is the core of what I spend 90% of my days doing. But at the same time, you have to make sure that the right people are hearing that music as well. And you have to be responsive to a totally different industry culture to what I was used to as a composer, where a lot of the creative direction basically came from you. You know, you had longer timescales. If you wanted to write a track in a particular style, even if it was for, you know, for a given brief, there was a lot of flexibility there. When you're working with studios, trailer houses who have been given the responsibility to market these incredibly valuable IPs, the whole business model just changes, and their expectations of you as a company, of your composers, of the quality of the productions you deliver is dramatically different. You have to, you know, and it's just, that's been the one of the big sort of takeaways for me is, we are here to serve a highly professional, very dynamic, high-pressure industry to solve their music problems, their sound design problems for them. And that means, you know, if they ask for something and they need it in 2 hours, they're not doing that just to be awkward, although we sometimes might suspect they are. It's because genuinely somebody higher up the chain in the marketing department at the studio has hit a hitch, a bump in the road, or somebody, some marketing exec has said, this isn't working, we quickly need to change direction. And you know, they come to us because they need us to help them. So, you know, and that's very much our ethos now, is that we, you know, we are here only to sort of serve the trailer houses and the studios and the streamers, obviously, to a large extent now, and make their lives as easy as possible.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we'll dig into sort of a couple of recent projects that you've been on, but I think if for anyone listening who doesn't quite know how, you know, the chain of events, the pyramid, if you will, of events when it comes to trailer music and how trailers get made from, you know, from the inception of, okay, studios making a movie. Can you just talk us through step by step that pyramid, and then that will hopefully give people an idea, then we'll dive into.
Yeah, I mean, obviously I see it, you know, really that and the music suppliers are kind of at the bottom of the pyramid, in that there is, you know, there is a Jurassic World or a Marvel movie or whatever it is. There is a marketing team at the studio who is charged with creating a whole series of assets that are going to be used to market that production. They go out often these days to multiple specialist advertising agencies that we call trailer houses. Those guys are specialists in creating theatrical trailers. Some of them do key art as well. And they then come out to us, usually fairly on in the process, not just to us. Obviously, there's a whole world of trailer music out there, and sometimes they don't need trailer music. Sometimes they'll use commercial music. Sometimes they'll use score. Sometimes they will get tracks written from scratch. But music is certainly sort of factored into the creative process very, very early on. I think if you've probably spoken to a few editors, the ones I speak to will always tell you that it's pretty much the first thing they do. They'll watch the movie, or they'll watch a rough cut or whatever footage they've been given access to, the dailies, etc., and then they'll start thinking about music. And once they find that cue or that song or that bed or whatever it is that they feel best captures their creative vision for the trailer, they will start cutting. Now, obviously, it may take 100 different twists and turns down the line. And I know that trailers often don't finish till they're literally in their V100 and something or others. You know, I'm used to signing off tracks at V4, 5, 6. Trailers just go to and fro. They take months and months. They get shelved. They come back into life again. Things change direction. The showrunners or the director gets involved and decides they want to, you know, have an involvement and change the way things are being run. So it's a long, drawn-out process. Sometimes, occasionally, they will find the perfect track and they will need to do very little with it, and they will just cut with that track. And sometimes they'll use multiple tracks. They say if you haven't got at least 100 tracks on your cue sheet as an editor, you're not trying hard enough. So, you know, these are very, very, very complex sound beds. Lots of music, lots of sound design, some existing commercial tracks, some, you know, old tracks, some classical music, whatever it may be, stems from different tracks layered together. You know, the editors, as you alluded to earlier, are real wizards with working with audio as much almost as working with video. So yeah, sometimes they'll come back to us if a track is close but isn't quite sort of pushing all the buttons, and they'll ask us to customize it. And that might mean we have to work a theme into an existing cue. It might just mean that we have to pull some parts out, add some extra parts in, more hits, more sound design, more intensity, bigger drums, whatever it is, until it's absolutely right. And that's typically how it works. And then usually it disappears. We hear nothing. Sometimes it disappears because something else has been picked in its place. If we're lucky, we then get a quote request from the studio saying, how much is it going to cost? We lick our finger, stick it in the air, come up with a number. And again, if we're lucky, it lands, you know, weeks or months later. But it's, it's a fairly complex process.
Yeah, absolutely. That's great. I think that sort of summarizes it quite nicely and probably segues nicely into going under the skin. Under the skin. The albums of music that you do, there's a couple, I can't remember, is it Dominus?
Yeah, Dominus and Fortis.
Dominus and Fortis, which are a couple of recent releases from Evolving Sound. Which, you know, obviously you've been out to Vienna as well to score those. Let's take one of those, for example, and just, I'm really interested in sort of your approach. So you presumably sort of, because I know, you know, reading the bio about Evolving Sound, you're very much looking to sort of the future, and it's sort of like, okay, trying to anticipate future needs. What are people going to want? What are, almost, you know, what movement can we start to trailblaze or sort of provide something that other people aren't providing? What's your starting point with the sort of like the concept of an album in terms of envisaging it, and then I suppose walk us through sort of that from the inception to sort of finalizing it.
It depends a little bit. I mean, you have to have some regard to what productions are in the pipeline. So with Fortis and Dominus, for example, we knew because of the pandemic there was a backlog of blockbuster movies coming out this year. There was also lots of very high quality streaming content that had a sort of more epic feel to it. The Lord of the Rings, House of the Dragon, The Witcher, stuff like that. So those are the kind of projects that these albums were aimed at. Fortis being slightly more dark fantasy, Dominus being a little bit more heroic action, but very much orchestral. And the thinking really with those specific albums, and it changes all the time, obviously, was I got a sense that in some respects the industry was starting to become a little bit nostalgic about slightly older style orchestral trailer music. We'd done the kind of great big gnarly synthy signature sounds, the big sirens and so on. Not that they'd gone out of fashion, just that they, you know, were used a lot last year, the year before. And so let's do a slightly more purist orchestral project, one aimed at fantasy, one aimed at more sort of heroic action. So that's, you know, with albums like that, you don't really have to think too much beyond that concept, except that for that style, I feel that whenever you have the budget and the opportunity, you should always record musicians live. It just sounds so much better. And we did have the opportunity, unfortunately, the budget. So we went to Synchron Stage, where Hans Zimmer and Lorne Balfe and the Gregson Williams and so on and so forth record a lot of their film scores. And it's just an amazing facility. Great, great players. We've recorded, I think, 5 or 6 orchestral albums before that in Budapest, which is also fantastic. Great players, good studio, and lovely people. And this was just, you know, dare I say it, just a slight notch above. And that's not to diminish the quality of the players in Hungary at all. It's just that they're more the facility than anything else. Was just custom designed. A lot of money had gone into it. So we spent a few days over there. I mean, it's very expensive, obviously, recording live orchestra. So you're constantly on a deadline. You're constantly, you know, looking at the stopwatch, trying to get through as many cues as you can in a session. Separate strings and brass session. That's how we typically work, just so that we don't have the brass drowning out the strings when we come to mix.
And do you get, when you sort of get in there and, you know, start, you know, recording the first cue and the orchestra strikes up,
I get goosebumps every single time. I mean, it's just amazing. And obviously there's a lot of preparation goes into it, so that the composers, some of them are classically trained and can just rattle off a, you know, full orchestral score no problem. Others aren't. So we had an orchestrator involved who prepared all the scores, and it just makes life so much easier if you've had, you know, somebody who really knows what they're doing, go through all the scores, go back to the composer if necessary and check, do you really want pizzicato here or do you want spiccato? Or, you know, just verify that the composer's vision is correctly articulated in what's been written down. And we liaise with the studio and the conductor. We sometimes in the past have even sent scores over to musicians to practice before the sessions. Normally, though, all these guys are so professional. First take is pretty amazing. Second take, they've basically nailed it. Occasionally, on a really tricky passage, you might need to go to a third take. And that's what you want, obviously, because the quicker they nail it, the better the score is, the more material you get through, and you know, the more you feel you've achieved from the whole process. So it was great.
And are you having the orchestra record to click?
Yes, every time,
so that you can drop in different takes.
Yeah, it doesn't mean you can't have tempo changes, but when we provide basically a click track a sort of master session, if you like, Pro Tool session for every cue that we're going to record, and that will have the click in it. It might even have some of the other parts, so some of the percussion we might include in there, so that the orchestra has a sort of loose framework for the rest of the cue. You know, if you've got a vocal or some choral parts or whatever that you're not recording live, you might include those. So you just give them as much context as you possibly can for their performance.
When you're not recording an orchestra, are you multi-tracking? Because you said you always like to get real strings or real elements in there. Are you multi-tracking sort of violins and cellos, yeah, and things like
so,
that?
So, I mean, we have done some smaller section recordings for sort of neoclassical projects and more of a chamber sound. And we've done sort of string quartets as well, either live or increasingly, I have to say, we're using two or three of our favorite string players and we're recording parts separately just because they know our workflow. They're amazing players. And in fact, we're working on an album at the moment called Heliocentric, which is kind of art house indie content. And there's a lot of live strings in there. But the easiest thing is to kind of get the bones of the cue together and then decide what we should record live, if we should add some extra live parts, and send it off to the string players we use, and they turn it around within a couple of days. If it's not quite right, we go back for another take. It just takes some of the pressure off, because if you've got sort of 6-7 up to, you know, 50 or 60 musicians there waiting and something isn't quite right, you can't go back. You've just got to, you know, if it's not right on the day, you're not going to get it right at all, and you're just going to have to fudge it later. So if you have the option to, you know, work with somebody that you can send parts back to if they're not perfect, then that just takes some of the pressure off.
And in terms of your process when you're planning, but also when you're listening back, are you planning an album in terms of obviously you've defined the sort of what the album's for, whether it's for sort of action cues, but are you sort of then going, okay, well, across sort of 10, 15, 20 tracks, I need several which are kind of maybe, you know, in a different time signature, I need several with this sort of feel. Are you trying to sort of get a broad spectrum which tick various different boxes for, or is it just sort of a feeling in terms of what composers turn in and whether it's
in an
good?
Ideal world, you want some variety on an album. And on occasion, we'll get halfway through and I will send a note out and just say, look, we're getting a lot of action drums. Can we perhaps go in a slightly direction with any remaining cues that are still in the pipeline? By and large, though, I tend to like composers to deliver what they want to deliver. I mean, obviously, that I do send out a super detailed brief. I mean, I'm horribly anal with my briefs. They go on for pages and pages, lots of references. So, you know, it gives people a pretty good idea of what we want. And I tend to find if we've got 12 to 15 composers probably on average involved on an album, you're going to get a fairly good mix of material anyway. And once you've worked with people for a few years, as we have with most of our roster of writers now, you can almost build the album when you select the composers you're going to involve, because you know the kind of tracks that they like to write. And that's not to say that they, you know, that they don't have diverse skills. It's just that they do, you know, people tend to have a preference, they tend to have a sound, and you know, that's good in many ways. It means that we can shape you know, the guys that we involve and the work they're likely to output into something that has a sort of cohesive, meaningful feel as an album. Absolutely.
Well.
And also, you know, we rarely sign off on a V1, as any composer that works with me will tell you. I'm sure they must hate me. But what that means is, you know, things do change between V1 and V5 when we finally say, yeah, that's perfect. So if it is a bit, you know, not quite on the right track, we have that opportunity to sort of steer it slightly differently as we're going through revisions, get live musicians involved, you know, just take it in a slightly different direction if necessary. So, you know, there's enough flexibility available to us because of the timescales that we're able to work to, that we can usually sort of, you know, get to a point where we're pretty happy with the mix of tracks we get. Guy, I wish for it every day. And it does. We get close. You know, there are some composers who they know so well what it is that, you know. Well, it is basically. But you see, the other thing is, I don't want them to write for me. You know, I know that I have my personal sort of preferences and tastes and styles and so on. So I constantly have to try and discard those and think, no, it's about the project. Let's think about what trailer is this track going to end up on, and if we want to really, you know, nail it down, what do we have to do to give it a, you know, the best possible chance of doing that. So that's really the motivation.
Well, it's a theme that keeps coming up in a lot of episodes as well, is the idea that, you know, when obviously as a composer, as a creative, you're creating something and then you're handing it in and you're waiting for sort of critique and notes, and it can, you know, from an egotistical point of view, it can sometimes be quite difficult, particularly when you've poured your heart and soul in. But I think what a lot of people have sort of talked about is the idea of reframing this is actually it's a collaboration. It's not just about you. And that, interestingly, chatting to Michael Price, we talk about, you know, as a composer, you're so bogged down in the sort of the nitty gritty of it that sometimes you don't have that perspective. You're trying to maintain it. But that's where actually this collaborative nature comes in, and having sort of like the exec producer come in and say, okay, well, hey, this is what I'm hearing. It's like, oh, okay, well, certainly that's a valuable perspective, but also sometimes is it sort of nudges you down an avenue of that you might not have found.
I think that's exactly right. And I think, you know, having been a composer, I know how when you've listened to something 300 times, you do start to lose perspective. And I, you know, I used to cycle 4 bars at a time looking for the perfect snare sound or whatever it was. And by the end of the day, it didn't mean anything anymore. Whereas when I get a fresh track in, and this is the, you know, the joy of my role, is I immediately know what's working and not's working. It's just an instinctive thing. I don't have to listen to it more than 2 or 3 times. I know the notes just come out, and you know, sometimes there's very few of them, but anything that isn't right just jumps out to me because I've never heard it before. So it's, you know, I'm hearing something completely fresh with no preconceptions, no expectations. So that, you know, that is, you're absolutely right. It's very much designed to be a collaborative process. And it's a problem, I think, if composers can't get behind that notion that we're all working together, you know, we're all a team. All we want is to give their music the best possible chance of securing a sync. That's, you know, we're all working towards the same ultimate end. And there are some composers who don't like taking notes. And as a rule, sadly, we struggle to work with composers who don't like taking. That's just the reality. It's just like an editor saying, "Well, this is a perfect edit, and if the studio doesn't like it, too bad." That, you know, it's just that equation just doesn't work. So,
yeah, absolutely. And I think that speaks also to the idea that people, that working relationship, if someone's sort of easy to work with, that goes a long way. If you could be the best composer in the world, but if it working with you is a nightmare, then it's going to be very difficult to have any kind of sort of do you have a little ritual, you know, when you're sort of sitting down to do a listening, like a cup of tea and a custard cream or something like that, ready to Brilliant. Well, that answers one of the later questions, which is, what's your favourite biscuit? Is a Jaffa cake a cake or a biscuit?
It apparently it's a cake. Yeah, so I'll have to rethink. Yeah.
And do you know why it's a cake?
No, I've no idea.
So theoretically, a biscuit, if you leave it out, goes soft, whereas a cake, if you leave it out, goes hard, dries up. So because a Jaffa cake goes hard, it's a cake.
And who came up with that definition, I wonder?
I imagine somebody with
too much time on their hands.
Some boffin at a university research facility who thought this would be a good PhD. Yeah, absolutely. Brilliant. Okay, well, that's some sort of fascinating insight into sort of the production process of an album. You touched on sort of earlier within the trailer world, the kind of bespoke nature of things, and obviously Jurassic World Dominion is a recent one that you sort of had a bespoke involvement in. Can you talk us through a little bit about through that process and how that came about and what the bespoke nature of that was?
Yeah, just a great project, incidentally. So lucky to be involved in that. We had a couple of little placements on the second Jurassic World movie, which I can't remember the name of. So off the back of that, I suggested to a few composers that we basically get a bundle of Jurassic Park / world orientated cues together on spec, which we do occasionally, especially if something has a theme, an IP that's exclusive to that particular franchise, then we'll get some spec tracks together and we'll take them to who we think are going to be working on that campaign. And I knew the in-house music guy. Universal Pictures have their own in-house kind of creative agency, so they have a trailer house within the studio. They don't do a lot of their campaigns. Most of them go out of house, but on some campaigns they keep a lot of that work in-house. And so I sent probably 5 or 6 cues to him a couple of years ago, and it was literally a couple of years ago, in fact probably even before the pandemic. And then, of course, everything got slowed down. Filming got held up. The movie release date got pushed back and back and back. And I thought nothing will ever come of this. And then last summer, we started getting asked if we could customize some tracks. They were obviously just in the sort of early stages of getting the campaign together. And they were trying all sorts of different approaches. But clearly our music had gone down well, which was amazing. And we did a whole bunch of stuff. Some of it was taking pop songs and working them into cues that we'd done. Some of it was taking bits of score and trying to adapt our cue to sound more score, and so on and so forth, and lots of different approaches. And then one of them started to get a bit of traction. So we worked a bit more on that. Then, as these things invariably do, it went very, very quiet for a while. And then it just came back with a vengeance, I think, last July-ish. And as I understand it, the trailer, this was for the original IMAX preview, I think it was called, which was going to be basically the very first bit of promotional material that went out. It was a long sort of 3.5 minute trailer that was shown. I think it was Fast and Furious 9 was coming out the same time, so they were sort of using that to piggyback the promotion over. We did a lot of late nights, lots of different approaches. As I say, the trailer, I think, had pretty much locked, but somebody had decided to open Pandora's box and start tampering with the music, which meant that it was all hands on deck and various sort of sirens were going off at Universal Pictures marketing headquarters, and they needed stuff done really quickly. So I think we did probably 5 all-night sessions with the composer, Chris Davey. And as these things invariably do, you'd do one thing and you'd think you were done, and it would come back the next night and it would be a totally different approach. You know, we heavily trailerized stuff, then we came back and we had to take all the trailerization out, and they wanted it to sound more like score. There was one night where they needed literally 45 seconds of fresh, totally new score, and they needed it 2 hours later. And this is just, you know, that's the nature of the beast. They were great to work with. The feedback was amazing. Eventually it wrapped, and again, we heard nothing for a while, and then got a confirmation not long after. And it wasn't a huge amount of our music. There's a lot of score in there, but obviously just an amazing project to be involved with. And very, very satisfying.
Amazing. I'd just pick up on something you mentioned there as well, because I think this is something, as a composer, it's always a line we're treading. You know, obviously the final product that we see on TV or on YouTube or in the cinema is very heavy on the trailerization, the impacts, the risers. But obviously a lot of that is kind of added by editors and or even sometimes in sort of, you know, post-production. To what extent do you build that into the music by default, and to what extent, how do you tread that line of knowing, okay, how far do we go down this? How true are we to just creating a beautiful piece of music? And then how much of the sort of infinite production bells and whistles are you sort of imposing on that track, and how much are you kind of leaving to people's imaginations?
Great question. As a rule, when we deliver a track, we want it to sound like a finished trailer. So as much of the sound design, hits, risers, all that stuff is already in there. What tends to happen is that often it'll stay in, and it won't get touched. But equally often, it'll all get stripped out and they'll put their own sound design in. Horror in particular, I mean, you can put, you know, all the jump scares and the big sort of swipes and slams and so on in all over the place, but they're never going to land exactly where the editor wants them to. So a lot of that stuff is going to get replaced. They may end up just using the bed of your track and then adding all the sound design themselves. And those guys are just, you know, wizards with sound design there. I mean, it's a real art form. So yeah, it depends, but ideally, we want the track to sound like it will sound in the trailer. And that means that if it's a big track, it's going to have sort of very hefty, epic, sort of giant wars, drums of war and so on. If it's something more intimate, we have to be more sensitive. It still needs accents and it still needs markers for editors to work around, but they have to be much more sympathetic to the style of the cue and the arrangement. So a lot of the sound design is in there when we deliver stuff, but every track we deliver we provide stems for. So I know, you know, as soon as an editor starts cutting with something seriously, the first thing they do is they drag all the stems into their session and they start muting stems. They start bringing their own sound design in, and you know, they will create something that's, you know, totally fresh.
And just further to that as well, because I think quite often the end product that we see, the trailer that we see, is often that the original piece of music, I mean, sometimes there's several pieces of music, but let's say for argument's sake that the trailer is using one particular piece of music, quite often that piece of music has been sort of cut up into a completely different sort of form and it is all over the place. And I think I know the answer to this, but I think for the sake of anybody listening, with the tracks of Evolving Sound, are you trying to sort of second guess that almost slightly sort of erratic, crazy trailer nature? Or is your commitment to the piece of music and ensuring that you have a piece of music which takes people on a journey and that can provide a narrative?
Again, great question. I think my philosophy is that making assumptions about where there might be a dramatic shift in mood or tone is really dangerous. So it's much, much better to have something that feels cohesive, and is consistent and has an identity, has a character, than to think, well, what if the trailer editor, what if the trailer suddenly goes from comedic to, you know, horrific at this point? Let's change everything. You know, we'd just be second-guessing something that we know nothing about. So it's much more likely in that scenario. We do sometimes, you know, we do get searches where somebody says it needs to start tense, but by the end it needs to be really hopeful. That's a slightly more organic sort of evolution. And there are tracks that sometimes they do evolve and the mood does change, but it tends to be more subtle, more gradual. And you know, if there's a real turning point, chances are the editor is going to need multiple cues to satisfy that and get exactly the right feel at exactly the right time. Or he's going to have to come back or go back to whoever's provided the music and say, can we customize this? Can we make this happy section scary or sad or more dramatic or more action-packed or whatever it is?
And interesting, and one thing I kind of wanted to pick up on as well, because I generally think of I think commercial music, probably production music and sort of trailer music, I often sort of think of it as a three-act structure. But I was interested on the Evolving Sound website, we're talking, Jules is obsessed with a four-act structure. I mean, I think for anyone who doesn't sort of feel free to elaborate on that, because I find that very interesting.
I mean, the theory is that you know, all stories, all trailers have a beginning, a middle, and an end, basically, and that's your three acts. In terms of when we're putting tracks together, what I tend to find, and it's not always the case, sometimes it just needs one act. You know, there's lots of trailers that use one slow burn cue from beginning to end, and it just builds gradually. It gets darker, it gets more intense, it gets more ominous, and that's all you need. By and large, people want to set the scene with an intro. They often want a break at the end of the intro. They want a midsection where they start perhaps introducing the beginnings of a plot or some characters. They want a bit more dynamism. They want some movement. It needs to feel like something's happening. It needs to have evolved a bit. And then they need the big final scene with the fast cuts and the sort of the drama and the action and so on, the back end, as we call it. The fourth act, as far as I'm concerned, is I find you often need some relief after the midsection, before the back end. So what we like to try and do, and it's not, sometimes it's used, sometimes it isn't used, is we provide and try and provide an interlude where you get to the end of the midsection, which is kind of built and built and built. And but before you just go straight to the back end, you might want to stop things down. You might need space for a couple of lines of dialogue. You might need a montage of something. You might need to reflect on something that's appeared earlier in the story. And it just gives, you know, at the end of the day, we're trying to give trailer editors the tools they need to do an amazing job. So if they don't use it, then everything's editable. But it's there if they do need it. And then actually we usually have a fifth act as well, because we usually need an outro. Usually you want a bit of music or sound design, some accents or markers to sit under title cards at the end as well. So there's a short fifth. Look, there's no hard and fast rules. Some one-act trailer tracks are just amazing. Sometimes you need three, sometimes four, sometimes five. Sometimes some people do two or three sort of broken up midsections, and that works great, you know. But it's nice to have a framework. It's nice to have a sort of benchmark, if you like.
Yeah, and I suppose that goes back to what you were saying as well about, you know, if you try to second guess every single eventuality for every single trailer, then it's, you're on a hiding to nothing. There's certain pieces of music will work for certain trailer types, others for not so much.
Yeah, and I think it's unusual for, I mean, it does happen, happens all the time, but it's not terribly common that one track gets used all the way through a trailer. So more often than not, when we get a quote request, 20, 30, 35 seconds of music, which means it's a midsection or it's a back end or it's an intro, or they've used a bit here and then they've used another bit later. So, you know, that's just the nature of the beast. These things get cut up and used in all sorts of fascinating, weird, creative ways. And you just want to be providing them with the raw material to just, you know, do something awesome.
Yeah. And as an editor, you know, as you say, you're providing the editor with a toolkit, and it's probably quite rare that an editor's cursing you because you've provided too much great material.
Exactly. And the problem, obviously, is that from a listener's perspective, if you're trying to create something that is purely for, you know, enjoyment's sake, it might not always flow as naturally as you'd want it to. But, you know, you just have to accept that compromise, because at the end of the day, you know, we're providing a service. And much as I love our music being on Spotify and people appreciating it, you know, the people who pay the bills are the guys who are actually cutting trailers and promos with it.
Absolutely. And it's almost like, as a composer, if, you know, you almost leave your artist hat at the door, because you are, as you've touched on earlier on, you are servicing, in the service of somebody else's vision, in service of something else, and you remembering that is definitely advantageous.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't mean it's not artistically satisfying or stimulating. It's still great fun. It just, you know, it does apply some additional, if you want to look at them as constraints, they're not really constraints, they're just challenges. You know, you have to, there, it's just an additional set of targets that you have to hit when you deliver a piece of music, that it's got to work in a certain context. It can't just be what happens to sort of spew out of your creative brain when you sit down in front of your door. You have to be mindful of how it's most likely to be used. At the same time, that can sometimes make things easier. You know, it gives you a framework, it gives you a starting point. So, you know, it cuts both ways.
Getting a taste. What's clear, increasingly clear, with all the conversations that I have with various people, is that we are all heavily influenced by art that we are exposed to throughout our lives. I think there seems to be a more formative period, sort of like teens into 20s, and that kind of informs us as sort of creatives. And whilst I appreciate, you know, on these albums you're not writing anymore, I imagine those influences are there in terms of how you're hearing things and notes you're giving. Can you sort of, looking back over time, are there certain, and this could be sort of film scores, but it could equally just be sort of albums or particular tracks that have really resonated with you and you feel have sort of shaped who you are creatively today?
Golly, that's one I definitely haven't prepared for. yeah, well, as I mentioned earlier, so I had a grandmother who was an opera singer, so I listened to a lot of classical music when I was younger, but, you know, basically pretended to hate it. Also listened to a lot of jazz, which I still love, and I still love a lot of classical music. Rimsky-Korsakov, Scheherazade was probably my favourite sort of classical work as a young man. It has a violin sort of motif that you just never forget. And then, yeah, I mean, I went through Scar. I was a mod. I played in a heavy metal band, played keyboards for a while. I got really into funk in my sort of late teens. Was in funk bands for probably 4 or 5 years. I loved soul. Yeah, I can't really nail it down to any one specific thing. I mean, I listen to film scores. I watch a lot of trailers, and I still, obviously love some of the classic trailers, the Alien, the first Alien trailer, which is just a sort of brooding, ominous building sound bed where the cuts just get gradually faster and faster. And I just think it's absolutely genius. I love the way people are starting to use diegetic sound in trailers, real sound effects. Trailers like, what's that Ben Affleck film? The Accountant, where it starts and he's sitting in a car and you hear the sound of the windscreen wipers. And then the windscreen wiper sound sort of morphs into a sound design, sort of rhythmic bed. And then that eventually morphs into a Radiohead track. Things like that I just think are very clever. Dance music obviously was really, really big for me in my 20s. I think I've pretty much run the gamut, to be honest. Everything. I don't think... Yeah, pretty much.
Are there any particular dance artists that you kind of aspired to emulate when you were on that scene?
Oh, I love BT.
British Telecom.
Brian Trasno, who's a progressive sort of dance artist who also then went into film scoring. I think he scored one of those very early, I don't think it was the first Fast and Furious, but it was one of those kind of street racing movies. He's super, super talented. The thing about dance was it wasn't so much about specific artists. It was like tracks. It was very rare for, it was about labels at the time. So there were, New York labels like Strictly Rhythm, for example, that you got into, and Nervous Records. Masters at Work, I absolutely worshipped, who kind of blended house and soul basically into dance music. And then, golly, who's the... I've just drawn a blank. Some of the great drum bass artists like the Upbeats, who we actually did a collaboration with on an album, our first Icon series. In fact, it was a track that just got used on the Doctor Strange trailer.
Oh, yes. So we
collaborated with the Upbeats, who are drum and bass guys from New Zealand. And my son is a massive drum and bass head, and he got me into drum and bass. So we wrote them in, and that was just a fantastic collaboration. They gave us lots and lots of bundles of amazing sound design and musical ideas, but from completely outside the trailer universe, very, very sort of EDM orientated. And that's kind of what you have to do with trailer music. You constantly got to be looking for something new and different, because everybody's using the same sample libraries. It's very hard to come up with, original direction, creative briefs. So I love guys like that. I love anybody who's doing something that just feels, fresh and a bit different. And I'm, still obsessive about production, constantly trying to find ways to get funky, new EDM flavored production devices into trailer tracks, stutters and glitches and all that kind of stuff.
Amazing.
Sorry, I haven't answered your question.
No, you have. That's great. what about the kind of, because obviously growing up in the Northwest, because Manchester's obviously had a pretty influential music scene over the years. Are there any particular artists from the sort of Manchester music scene that you can cite as being inspirational?
The weird thing, I wasn't a huge sort of Manchester fan. I like the Stone Roses and the Happy Mondays and those guys, but I'd be lying if I said I was down the Hacienda every weekend. I don't know what I was doing. I was probably, playing piano and being a nerd at home.
What about metal? You mentioned metal. Were there any particular sort of metal bands that you were sort of...
Oh, God, I loved Rush. Absolutely loved Rush. And big Iron Maiden fan. It was that phase of your life when you start to appreciate real musicianship. And, if you're into commercial music, then you had to basically get into rock, because that's where all the great musicians were peddling their wares. Yep. I tried to learn guitar at the time. I was terrible at it. So, but, you get into those guys, and you just watch the artistry and the skill set that they have. Mm. Whether you like the music or not, you have to admire how good they are.
Yeah. Yeah, and those big riffs, you know, I sort of think back, like people like Enter Sandman by Metallica, they just do something. Guns N' Roses as well were a big influence for me, and yep. those huge yep. riffs, and you sort of go, wow, it's on a kind of a different level.
Absolutely.
Fantastic.
Yeah, no, Rush was probably my favourite for a long time. They did an album called Moving Pictures, which I just absolutely adored. Mm.
Amazing.
I call it Neil Peart, who died last year, the Rush drummer, who was just probably one of the best drummers of all time. Mm.
Yeah. Weirdly, with drummers, one of the things that kind of, I think this probably speaks to, because I'm a huge funk fan still. To this day, saxophone was my first instrument. So I always used to just put on funk tracks and jam to them, and I loved it. And similarly with drums, but with something about a drum solo, any soloing, but particularly drum solos, for some reason, when somebody lets rip on a drum kit, it just
it's crazy. I remember seeing Buddy Rich, I think, yes. it was, he was a jazz drummer live, mm. and he did a drum solo. It went on for about 12 minutes, and it was just absolutely incredible. Mm. And I, as I said, I loved 70s funk, you know, Commodores and Funkadelic and George Clinton, those guys. There's just something. It was almost more about the spaces yeah. than the actual music, yeah. you know, the timing, just the feel, the syncopation. Mm. It's a shame we can't do funky trailer tracks. They just don't work, unfortunately.
Yet. That weird yeah. crossover moment may come when you least expect it.
If I crack it, I'll let you know. I just can't see it working somehow.
Well, Jules, I'm conscious of time. I'm very, very grateful for you taking the time to chat. It's great. We'll finish up. I've got a couple of sort of quick fire questions for you.
Mm.
The first one is usually, what's your favourite biscuit? But Jaffa cake. That. Although technically a cake, but I think...
Figaro. If I can't get Jaffa cakes, Figaro,
yeah.
They are a biscuit, aren't
I think
they?
So, yeah. Second question is, if you could go back in time and give your younger self one piece of advice, what would it be?
Oh, God, just learn music. Acquire skills as quickly as possible, and then probably specialize, decide what it is that you really love and just go for it. I've been very lucky. I have a son who's currently a composer. He's just graduating from Berkeley. So I've been able to vicariously, you know, see him do all the things that I wish I'd been able to do. And there are such amazing facilities and resources out there now for young composers that there weren't really when I was growing up. You either studied music at university or conservatoire, or you know, you did something else basically, and there, you know, that's not the case anymore. If you want to be a producer, if you want to study, you know, electronics and music or coding or whatever it is, you know, there's a way to study it. And I do think if you can acquire those skills at an early age, it's such a competitive marketplace out there. You know, it definitely helps. And I had none of that. You know, if you don't have those skills, it's going to be tough.
Mm. Yep, definitely. But you know, that said, I quite surprised actually by the number of sort of guests I've had on the show who are composers and producers and have had no, myself included, have had no sort of like formalized education in it. Although I did learn saxophone and instruments, and that knowledge of music has definitely, without doubt, been sort of, you know, a crucial part of my journey.
Yeah, look, I'm, it's never going to make up for pure passion and commitment and determination, but it's certainly really useful to have.
What scares Jules Bromley?
Oh, my God. What scares me?
This question.
Yeah. when you're running a business, and we're expanding at the moment, so we're just taking on a new creative production manager, a new administrative assistant, we've moved to new offices, you do have to be mindful of whether you're going to be able to pay the bills. That's the thing that scares me. You know, whilst you're small and starting out, it's all fun and exciting and it's great, and I still feel equally passionate about trailer music and the whole trailer industry, but yeah, there's a reality when you're running a business in a scary, volatile world, as we've seen over the last couple of years. Things can happen from one day to the next, and cinemas just shutting down was pretty terrifying. Wondering if there were ever going to be theatrical trailers again, or, you know, if it was all going to be streaming only. So I do worry about just making sure that we can pay our composers. I mean, we're always going to be able to pay our composers, but pay our staff, make sure we're doing the best by them, make sure we're securing placements for people who trust us with their content. You know, that is a big responsibility, because I know what it's like as a composer. You hand over something to a label or a production music library, and you know, you put all your faith in them that they're going to help you earn some money out of it. And it's not easy earning a living as a composer at the moment. So, yeah, those are the things that keep me awake at night sometimes.
And finally, what's a little-known fact about George Bobley?
Little-known fact? Golly. I'm half Austrian. Is that interesting?
I think so, yeah. That speaks to, you know, going to studying modern languages and German. There's obviously the German connection there.
There you go. So my opera singing grandmother was Austrian. Right. My mum is Austrian.
Amazing.
There you go.
Perfect. Well,
sorry, it's not more exciting.
That's fine. Oh, the other thing, I keep sort of forgetting this in other episodes, but I'm kind of obsessed with kind of weird and wonderful trivia about movies or bands or music. To give you an example, one of the ones that's come up in previously was that the sound of the T-Rex, I think it was, in Jurassic Park. No, the Velociraptors in Jurassic Park was sound design. It was basically the sound of tortoises mating. And that was sort of turned into the... Do you have any kind of... It could be sound design, music, any sort of weird and wonderful trivia facts that you happen to know off the top of your head?
I have a friend who did all the sound design for... What was that dinosaur documentary that the BBC did a few years ago? And it was really good. And they did all the dinosaur sound. And the thing about doing dinosaur sound design, obviously, is there's no dinosaurs. So you can't just go into the wild and record them. Having said that, I can't remember. But he did tell me that, you know, he did some pretty crazy stuff to make dinosaur sounds involving, you know, old bicycles and teapots and, you know, whatever he could sort of lay his hands on. A lot of the stuff you hear in music is not what you think it is. I had a track in the other day, and I was emailing the composer saying, yeah, that fantastic sort of high string signature that we've got in the back end, because he's a string player, we want to bring that out a little bit more. And he said, that's actually not strings. It's a trumpet that I blew the wrong way from the bell or something. So, sorry, I don't have any, fascinating trivia.
That's all good. I think that's just sort of raised the question for me is like, Black Sunday by Cypress Hill, the album. I loved that album. And in a lot of the tracks, there's this sort of like... which almost sounds like there was a kind of parakeet or something in the studio when they were recording, but I've always wanted to know what that is. So, you know, answers on a postcard, anybody who happens to know, that would literally a life's quest to understand what that noise was.
I can't help you there. Squeaky bicycle?
Could be. Chain. Yeah, could be, yeah. Anything. Yeah. Well, I seem to think that Chewbacca in Star Wars, the sound of him sort of roaring was a cross between a grizzly bear and a walrus. They sort of, you know, pitch down a walrus and then put a grizzly bear on top of it, and you've kind of got this sort of roar. So,
wow, I love all that stuff. We do some albums that are built around just field recorded sampling, basically. In fact, that with one of our composers is in session today, beating up a Steinway grand piano for a current album, not playing it, just basically making as many weird sounds with it as possible, which will hopefully be on our next album. Yeah, watch out. Heliocentric.
And also, yeah, just to mention as well, we've got this Fortis and Dominus are two albums. Are they out yet, or are they coming out?
They are out for the industry exclusively at the moment. So the way it tends to work is just because the studios have certain requirements in terms of exclusivity, everything goes to them first, to the trailer industry, so to speak, and gets released more widely about a year or so later. Just they get first bite at the cherry.
And if anybody does want to, obviously there's the Evolving Sound website. Do you social? Is there, if people want to sort of not get in touch, yeah, but follow you?
Yeah, yeah. LinkedIn, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter.
Just search Jules Bromley.
Just search, search Evolving Sound.
Evolving Sound.
Evolving Sound is, yeah.
Brilliant.
Where it's at.
Jules, thank you so much for taking the time to chat. It's been fascinating.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks so much, Jim.
Good luck with everything. And hopefully one day I might meet you face to face.
Yeah, well, if you're ever up in the Northwest, drop in for a cup of tea.
I'm on my way to Leeds. I sometimes go past, so maybe I will. All right, Jules. Cheers, mate.
Be lovely to see you. Thanks, cheers. Jim.
Thank you very much for listening. If you've enjoyed this episode, and given that you've listened this far, I feel you might have, then I would be honoured and incredibly grateful if you could take a moment to subscribe, rate, and review on your podcast platform of choice. By subscribing, you'll automatically be notified each time a new episode drops, and by rating the show, you tell the artificial intelligence that will soon be running the world that this podcast is worth listening to. I certainly get a lot of insights and value from these conversations, and I genuinely hope you do too. If you'd like to get in touch with the show, then you can email me, podcast@larpmusic.com. Larpmusic.com is my digital abode, and the home of the podcast is larpmusic.com/Sync Music Matters Podcast, and Sync Music Matters Podcast is hyphenated. Thanks again for listening, and until next time.